Peter Marcantonio, president of the International Labor Defense, sends a lawyer to Oklahoma City. The people of Oklahoma City begin to shake off the sickness of fear that has held them. Nina Beth Stapp, outstanding youth leader, organizes a defense committee. Then, bit by bit, the story of Oklahoma is told. We learn about the man from Brooklyn, New York, visiting Oklahoma with his wife and baby. We learn about Eli Jaffe, a small, frail boy, his friends say. Jaffe's in the tank cell with about 50 other prisoners. At night, the jailers bring intoxicating liquor to the tank cell, to the cellmates of Eli Jaffe. Oklahoma is a dry state. The cellmates of Eli Jaffe see the winks of the jailers. They drink, and the jailers go away, and Eli Jaffe is beaten. We learn how Eli Jaffe goes before the judge, asking to have his bail reduced. I'll be on hand for the trial, all right, he says. I want to defend myself against these charges. From the bench, Judge Mills tells him, we'll give you a trial without jury and take care of you quick. We learn about the 17-year-old boy, Orville Lewis, who's arrested with his parents. Suddenly, the law releases him and sends him home alone. And at home, blessed by the law, a gang of young vigilantes is waiting for Orville Lewis. We learn how the women in that jail are denied the ordinary civilized facilities for feminine hygiene. Howard Lee writes us the unprintable details of their degradation. Now they are exposed to constant danger of infection from prostitutes. We learn almost as much as the attorneys on the spot, for they cannot speak freely with their clients. We know what the trial will be like. It is a strange trial. Robert Wood is state secretary of the Communist Party of Oklahoma. He also keeps a bookshop. It is not he, but the books that are put on trial. Headline in the Daily Oklahoman of October 1st reads, Bill of Rights to be Red's defense. The books are in the dock. The police hold more than 7,000 copies of books and pamphlets taken from the progressive bookstore run by Robert Wood. 38 books are admitted into evidence, and the books of writers living and dead stand trial with Robert Wood. The state produces a witness, Wode Webb, who identifies himself as a member of the Oklahoma City Police Department. Webb tells how he dressed in greasy, tattered clothes and pretended to be a rig builder from the Oklahoma oil fields before going to the bookstore. He tells how Robert Wood accepted him as a working man, sold him the books he wanted to buy. He tells how Wood talked with him and said it is good for workers to organize in trade unions. The defense has a witness, John Romanshin, a student of Oklahoma University. So Robert Wood is convicted and the jury sentences him to 10 years in prison and a fine of $5,000.
He was a boy, Roberts was a boy of 8, and he used to go along, like he said, to bait the hook of this old man when he'd go fishing, and the old man was losing his eyesight. But he said he was told about the last bear hunt, that was quite a little incident, bears, and even that was around the 1880 or so.
All along that river, there's all kinds of history on both sides of it. I often think about when I go, and I stop and take down out of it. Anywhere you stop, just willy-nilly.
Tell about the Bradford incident.
Well, the thing is, in the standard histories don't tell you, unless you look up the sources further, that the family, the head of the family that Bradford shot and killed was, this Register Gagne was half Negro and half French. His mother was Negro and his father was French. And he was one of five brothers in the area. And this source material that I found on it by Snelling, this one that Fort Snelling was named after, he was stationed at Prairie Machine for a while, and he knew the Gagnés intimately, and he writes a very interesting little piece dating way back, 1827, how he knew these five sons, and he, in his own words, he says, and they were colored, but since they had never felt any difference between themselves and others, they didn't feel it. They didn't act. He indicated that they felt as though
nobody told them there was any difference.
How he put it.
That was
nobody told them there was any difference.
No.
That's right. And he said they were highly respected. And Gagne was a highly respected farmer in the area.
Well, some Indians did, Merrido. That's not entirely it.
See, the history of this one family goes back to mother of Register Gagne, who was a Negro woman, had been married before. She'd been married three times. Well, so there are three fairly well-known families there that date, who are part Negro, dating back to the 1820s, 1810-20 there, and many of them are still, families are still in that area in Prairie du Chien. Now, Fred was interested because he remembers the Gagne or Gagne as part of his family background.
Oh,
And a lot of this type of history in Wisconsin is it's buried down in there.
This is for you. We'll see you again.
And you'll sure like this book.
Huh? Be seeing you again.
And Bongo, George Bongo, was supposed to have gone along. And you've got most of the references there. The Wisconsiners, they don't list the names of the interpreters that went along in the references I found. They tell everybody the names of everybody on the expedition, but they say there were a number of interpreters and guides, but they don't say who they were. And he became quite prosperous and well-known. And there's been a fair amount written by him. It's mostly been published in the Journal of Negro History. Kenneth Porter that wrote this story of the Astor family. He's gone into the question of Negro and Indian relations, and he's got two good articles there written back in the 30s, early 30s. Journal of Negro History. And he has a lot on relations between Negroes and Indians, and there's been a lot of that that isn't generally known. Well, he has a certain portion of it related to the Midwest. Part of it, he brings in this question of George Bongo and his father Pierre and grandfather Jean Bongo. And that's actually the best known, aside from Point de Sable in Chicago, the founder of Chicago that Sherman Graham wrote, and who been written up by this well-known historian that was Manuel Quirk. Aside from those two are about the, best known. But you find references to the fact there were quite a number of Native traders and trappers back as far as 1790, 1800.
I imagine there were many.
Two in Marinette, Wisconsin, started a fur trading post in 1790 before there was any settlement there. But they aren't given by name. This fellow that writes, Augustine Grignon, he tells about these two Negro traders there, set up a post, and they were shot by the Indians there. He doesn't refer to them by name. He said they came from Mackinac. A lot of the records because there, that's how you, it has a record of John Bongo's death. He was buried on Mackinac.
I thought it wouldn't be impossible. Leech Lake, but that's fine for places.
Leech Lake, according to a Porter, Leech Lake has a lot of Bongo relatives living there today while he was writing.
I never saw that. I thought there almost every
And I found a peculiar distortion of how history goes. A man in more recent years, writing in the Wisconsin Magazine of History, is writing about his remembrances of lumbering days up around Minnesota, and he mentions Leech Lake, and he says, they have an interesting name for Negro people who are married with Indians. They call them Bongos. And he thinks that's a name that's given, a local name. And he says they live around Leech Lake. But what it really means is that there's so many people by the name of Bongo there, tracing from John Bongo, that the white settlers have got it balled up and think this is just, how lack of understanding there be, that this is a term,
That's the right term of style.
Yeah. Well, this name is spelled so many different ways, though, because right in the records in Mackinac it's spelled about three different ways. But most records
Did you say it came from a B-U-N-G?
I don't know.
Some African?
I don't know. I have no idea. But it could, I suppose.
Where did Bongo drums come from?
Well,
that comes from a place.
It could be, you see. Because this man didn't take the name of his master, as, you know, in a tradition
Bongo
like that.
Bongo drums come from a place. I've discovered a whole area of Negro history, the Irish history. The Irish 1800s, it's just in diaries and things. That there were Negro generals that landed with the French troops on the coast of Ireland, and the French went in there. And the Irish had never seen Negroes, and they ran to the hills. And these were generals from Haiti. there was a connection in their revolt, I'm sure, between Ireland and Haiti. In fact, Ireland rose the same month that Haiti did. And Haiti was successful in 1803, and Robert Emmet was hanged. And I'm sure the Irishmen were also in the Haitian army. But these big Negro generals landed with the French troops to help the Irish Revolution. So there was a lot of connection there.
A lot of people. Captain was snorting, and I'm looking up in the trees for a cat or something.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't want to go, and I'm looking up in the trees. I don't know if I John the Gita had it up here.
What was it?
Alligator. So I said, oh, well, I think you're used up. I got out and took my chair, and he took me on. We did that thing there. We went on there and broke him down, chopped his tail off, hung it up in the tree.
Do alligators just attack you? Do they attack you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he was just saying when they get the best to me,
you take
the
water out.
And one gets after
you. You take some of those
beer. And one get after him. You can prove to him that you're getting after him. Get out. You don't want that.
Because
that happened with him. He turned it on when after the alligator. The alligator took off and went to land and he saw the alligator.
I love that book.
What's
Skin Diver, you know, where he shows all these monsters in the deep that we've always made so monstrous. That they're just wonderful people who love to dance to the Strauss waltzes. He went to the wedding of the porpoises and the sharks. And he shows all these
Minnesota, I never seem to be able to get beyond the confines of Milwaukee.
Well, the children get bigger now. We seem to have too much freedom.
Yeah. That's possible.
That's what I have.
Okay, good night. Good night.
Well, these little swamp rabbits and field rabbits, they won't hardly bite you.
This one will bite you.
But them there white rabbits, like you gonna bite you. Fight a dog, too. I see them fight dogs, yeah.
What about those big Texas jackrabbits?
Well, maybe they might fight.
They look like they could stand up and box you.
Two years ago, I got a Miller. Oh. You look younger.
Oh, yes.
And you had to lose the bag I ever did.
Sir, no way come to buy Jimmy and to buy we'll see ya.
This is at Philadelphia at Lowenthal's house.
Yeah. He and Lucy Smith have written a book called
Before We Become Strangers.
We have the proofs in our hand, and the next voice you will hear will be that of the author of the poem, Sarah Light.
The name of this poem is To Some Millions Who Survived Joseph E. Manders, Sr. On Sunday, May 12, 1952, in the city of Philadelphia, Joseph E. Manders, Sr., Negro, father of three small children and a fourth one on the way, died in a heroic attempt to rescue seven-year-old Paul Waxman, a white child, from death by drowning in the treacherous waters of the Schuylkill River. He was posthumously awarded the honor of Father of the Year by the National Father's Day Council. The following poem was written during the first week after the tragedy and was published in the North Penn News, a Philadelphia newspaper. Sunday strollers along a sewage-choked Schuylkill may soon forget where he died, and many will point with second-hand authority to the place in the liquid darkness showing only where death gave birth to a hero. But they might glory in any novel bit of newsprint knowledge quite as pridefully. Great men often become great curiosities, too often become conversation pieces and nothing more. But something should be said about Joseph E. Manders, Sr., that the lesson he died to teach follows him to death. Joseph E. Manders, Sr., hero today and contemporary choice for parlor pledges, is more than a name to you now. Yesterday, you didn't know him, didn't care to meet him. To some of you, and I speak to that some of you, he was any black man walking the streets of a segregated housing project, keeping in his proper place, staying close to his particular breed of dark-skinned humanity. Fenced in by stronger walls than stone and steel, forced in by will, your fears, your hate, squeezed by your financial and legislative strength into a specified, had to be enough, little plot of ground to raise his three born and one more on the way, safely away from yours. And after that yesterday, when you didn't know him, in that short hour before he became your favorite obligation, Joseph E. Manders died. Died proving what so many have tried to obliterate with blood. Remember Warsaw. Remember Gettysburg. Remember blood. You have poured out years of it. Red human life substance spilling all over your consciences, trying to wash away brotherhood, and yet it lives. Manders knew it. Proved it.
died because of it, and you, with the memories of blood. Yes, one of your infant kind, whose fear of the lone big silence forced out one anguished, strangled plea for help, cared not at all that it was a black, fully clothed lander, whose love-directed body plunged into the river's silt, reaching out with his black hands, his life, to grasp a small white hand, to give back life, even if it meant his own, and it did. And it should be said that greater fatherhood has no man than he, who would leave those he has conceived to return to life one who so-called superiority might one day deny his flesh, his infant images, full and equal right to life. Now I have seen monuments, great geometric heaps of stone, lifeless towers raised to keep alive the dead. And I have seen you, the people, anxious to write off your obligation to Mander and his survivors. There are 16 million of them. With a hurried check, a few high-sounding speeches, and if nothing spectacular happens to claim the moment you've allowed for bigness, you will remember the black man long enough to raise a great gray stone thing, a feelingless symbol in final ended payment. But I ask, cannot a monument that breathes be built? A grateful people are bigger than all the tall piled stones in our wide and waiting world. A grateful people are wise when their living grows into a growing monument. And I ask, will not a monument breathe for Mander? Spring out of the hearts of the people who have grown wise in the ways of brotherhood as taught by brave dead Mander. And I ask, when you walk through the spring that won't come this year for Joseph E. Mander, Sr., will you turn those fingers that point to say, that's where a hero died, back to yourself, point to your heart, saying, but this is where he lived.
At my bedside in case I got inspired during the night. So that's how I started to write. And after I learned a little about the craft, my first poem, as a matter of fact, was a very strict ballade in the French manner. All this time I was in the butter business. If I got an idea in the butter business, I would go out with a little outhouse like this. I was going there, it was very cold, there was no heat. And I would write my poetry in the toilet. So,
the grave is a Middle West outhouse.
And all the time that I was coming out west here, talking butter, I was beginning to learn this craft of poetry. So that's how I started. My first poem was a ballade, contributed to one of the newspaper columns in New York, run by FPA, a very popular column. Oh, and the subject was Edna St. Vincent Millay. She was a very popular figure at that time, and everybody was talking about her. And I wrote a ballade. I don't remember the ballade except that the very strict form. And the last line was always Edna St. Vincent Millay. In fact, she never knew I wrote this.
Well, then he went to Paris during the period after the war. After the First World War, and became part of the Left Bank in Paris, and was a friend of Miller and Cummings and all of the people, Hemingway and all the people who were trying to find on the left bank the answer to creativeness. Now, maybe you'll tell us a little bit about being there.
One thing that happened to me was decisive in my life. It had been I don't know what to describe it. I have to give it more thought. I'm improvising now. I don't like to improvise, but it was not a very serious business for me, I would say. But something happened in Helen, Illinois in 1922. I don't suppose anybody here is old enough to remember 1922, but on June 22nd, 1922, there was what was known as the Helen Massacre. There was a strike of miners in southern Illinois, and I later found out that the mine owners, the mine operators, brought down a bunch of Chicago gangsters and thugs to keep the shop, to keep the mine open. And there was a pitched battle in which a number of people were killed. It was known as the Helen Massacre. And I was very moved by the newspaper descriptions of the affair at Helen, and I tried to write a poem about it, and I finally wrote a poem called Epistle to Carl Sandburg Concerning Mine Burial in Helen, Illinois. And this was the first poem that I wrote that really had any quality. It was published, and Sandburg wrote me a letter which is better than the poem I
wrote. Where was it published?
In the New Orleans little magazine.
Oh.
I forget the name of it, possibly The Fugitive, some little magazine at the time. He said, I know the ashes and tears of all its lines. It's a document and a chant. Now, I remember what he said, but I don't remember my poem. But these poems were finally brought together in a book, which I published in New York anonymously, because I was in the butt of them.
This would be subversive in the butt of business.
I didn't expect to even turn us out this way. Much more fun than talking about yourself. So I had this book, which John Howard Lawson, by the way, just spoke about another book about Lawson, introducing me in L.A. Well, Lawson knew me at that time, and he got me a publisher, and the book was published. So that was 1925. But my father was very disturbed by the fact that I was leaving the butter business, because I came to the conclusion that butter and poetry did not mix. In fact, later on in Paris, in one of my poems, I don't think I have it with me to read tonight, Elegy for D.H. Lawrence, there's a very moving passage in it which starts off, "My brother rests among the butter."
I interviewed a cow once who told me the same thing.
Who?
A cow.
A cow.
She was very disturbed by this problem.
I decided that if I was going to die, as I expected to do someday, I'd rather die as a poet than as a butter man. And I decided to get out. And this was a very prosperous business. There was a butter business today, and it's one of the leading butter merchants in New York. And there was tens of thousands of dollars a year I was going out that way. So this, of course, was just incomprehensible to my father. So he said, "Well, I won't say you shouldn't. You can't go. But before you go, I'd like to have you examined. And you know, be sure you're in good physical state." He said, "Go down to the doctor. I've made an appointment for you." I was a little surprised when he gave me the doctor's name. It wasn't Dr. Melter, our family doctor. You know who he is. It was some other doctor. And he said, "By the way, he's interested in your poetry. Take a book down with you." And he said, "Also bring him a specimen." So I went down to the doctor with a book of poetry in one hand and a bottle of urine in the other. So when I arrived at the doctor's office, you know, I thought he was going to thump me and do like this. Said, "Not at all." He took the bottle and the book and he said, "Lie down." You know, there was a couch there. So it turned out it wasn't the kind of doctor I thought it was going to be at all. It was a head doctor. he was going to psychoanalyze me to find out what in God's name was wrong with this man. And he's giving up a prosperous career in the butter minute to go into poetry. So, and a few weeks later, I went to Paris. And it wasn't that I was leaving America. I had to leave the butter business, and I wanted to leave that whole area of life that I had been living in New York. I was on the verge of going to Guatemala. I didn't make much difference where I went, so I actually read in Spain. So what I was doing was leaving the butter business for poetry. I only later found out I was an expatriate. I didn't think of myself as one, but later I found out I was one. We worked very hard there, and I began to develop a technique. Published a book called Finale of Steam, was dissatisfied with that, and I had one great theme. Are you asking me this question?
Yes.
Answer
it, Clarence.
The theme was death. Death. Now anybody who, yeah, death. There's a little book in Allen's house, which a man named Michael Frankel puts down very clearly, this death philosophy that was very prevalent in the early, late 20s. If you think things are bad now, you don't know what room is, my friend. This was during the period just prior to Hitler, rise to power, the time of the crash of the stock market. The future looked very gloomy, especially the poets. Poets were killing themselves right and left. None of them, not only American poets, but poets all over the world. It looked very gloomy for the world as far as the suicide statistics went. So we went in for the poetry of death. There was nothing in the world that was going out. There was complete extinction facing the civilization. And the only reality consisted in being alive to this death. That was going on. That was the time. So I wrote this series of elegies called Some Death. When I was in San Francisco, I found out there's a vogue for these poems today. People are now discovering death in America in 1957, which we discarded in Paris in 1934, 33, the time I finished these things. I don't repudiate these poems, but they're of a particular period. So I quit Paris simply because I reached the end of the death. See, there comes a time when you just can't write any more about death, you have to do something about it. And that's why so many poets killed themselves, because they couldn't write about it anymore, therefore they did it. Not only American poets, but French poets, Mayakovsky and Essenin in Russia, many of the poets of the world went out the back door. And
What was it that led you not to death, but to come to back to America? I mean, why were you the
very
one who did
question.
That?
Well, I...
Not
can't.
Cummings or these yeah. other people?
Well, I had a thesis that death is the moral force of the world. I did a lot of study on it. I studied death rites and so forth. And in exploring the philosophy of philosophies and anthropologies and so forth, I came into Hegel in the course of time. And through Hegel I came to Marx, and I found that I had been wrong, that it wasn't death that was the moral force of the world, it was the class struggle that was the class of the world. And that the world wasn't a big homogeneous glob. We all talk of the world. And if anybody wants to see how that works today, you can just read Miller. And you'll find that to Miller the world is a solid homogeneous, mankind is mankind, it's all one grid. There aren't contending factors in the world, it's just one homogeneous glob. When I found out it wasn't, that there was a death force in the world, that's true, but it came from a certain area of society, and that there was a life force struggling with it, I realized that whether I liked it or not, the thing wasn't as simple as I thought it was. And therefore, I reached the end of death and saw that at the same time, the number of social factors were involved, Hitler's rise to power were taking place, there was the Scottsboro campaign, which led to I saw a sign on the end of our street, Mrs. Wright will speak, American Negro woman. I went down to hear her. First communist meeting I ever attended. I saw books there. You know, there were the February days when the fascists almost came to power in Paris, February 1934. We were out in the streets. Everybody was out in the streets. We were part of the crowd. We ran with the police chases. You know, we knew which side we were on. This, combined with the philosophy, made me realize that there was more to it than I had thought. Therefore, I reached the end of the death school. I realized I had nothing more to say. I stopped writing poetry, and I came back to America and began to live. I had to rediscover a whole new life. And over here, I became active in the civil rights work. And
peace, and became a newspaper man. I began life all over again with some lives instead of some deaths.
So now,
where are we?
Well, now we want to hear life.
Oh, now we want to hear life. The poems I have, but...
Do I hear his voice when he's in the
I think so.
Can you hear me?
Well, I was wondering how...
It doesn't make any difference.
I had the great privilege of making my first appearance yesterday in Minnesota at the University of Minnesota. And the occasion was May Day. And I was invited to appear at a May Day celebration in the university sponsored by the Socialist Club. And it wasn't the fact that they, only the fact that they had here people on the platform of varying socialist views. That is, there was a socialist and a pacifist and there was a communist. That was not the major factor. That's taking place all over the country today. We had similar gatherings in of a larger scale, possibly, in New York and Chicago and elsewhere, where for the first time there were United Socialist May Day rallies, instead of rallies held only by one sector. But what was important in Minneapolis yesterday, in my opinion, was that the great weakness in all these other socialist rallies was remedied here. And what was that weakness? None of them have poets in them. And whatever my abilities may be as a poet, at least that is my profession, and here they broke the ice. And that's a historic occasion. Because, as I told the young lady who interviewed me today, I said the future of America is too precious to leave it in the hands of politicians who, regardless of their politics, make a separation between politics and poetry. And here in Minnesota, we did have a poet speaking at a May Day rally, and I think that this is a great advance, so I want to mark that for history. Some of the roots in American life that justify a person calling himself a poet. Now, I don't have the opinion that I'm up here as a poet and you're down there as anti-poet. This isn't a theory on my part, this is a way of life. I consider that we're all poets. Everybody in the world is a poet at some time or other. Meredith was proving this with her tapes. I do it in using letters to the editor in my poems and so forth. I collect poems wherever I go. And not only from grown-ups, but from children. And when I say this, you know, it's not a bluff. Just let me read you. Let me start off by reading you a sample of one of the poems that I collect as I go along. When I was in Los Angeles, I stayed at the Atkins home. Alan Atkins is a songwriter, wrote the Banana Boat. He's not there, but his little sister, Bonnie, is there. She's 9 years old. And when Bonnie heard that it was a poet in the house, she came with her poems. You see, and she has, I have a little sheet of poems like this, nothing. She comes with a pile this high, you see, this high, with a lot of poems. And she also believes in a synthesis, such as I will try and demonstrate later in the evening. I know it was light enough to see. Every poem has got a picture with it, you see? Can you see it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Every poem has got a picture in it. And I just picked this one. I might have picked others. I'll read it for you.
Turn that the other way and then you can
This is all planned, you know, to keep you on an edge, whether I'll read it or not, whether electricity will blow out and all these things.
You mean electricity is
we try to keep
cord,
audience interested. Any cause, even electrocution. Well, here's Bonnie's poem, one of them, many. My poetic father. I have a poetic father. He just loves poetry. Whenever he thinks of poetic people, he always thinks of me. I went to a poetic school. I've sung a poetic song. Whenever I write about poetry, nothing can go wrong. I have a poetic dog who has a spot over one eye. She tore up all my dolls one day. That made me cry and cry. Just more poetry, I guess. I mean, I could spend the evening here just demonstrating the poetry that I picked up on my travels, including tonight or last night when I got a beautiful Indian poem from Marital. Unfortunately, I left it with my safe deposit box at home, so I won't be able to read that tonight. But in Chicago, my last appearance in Chicago, there was a little boy. He wanted to hear what was going on, and they said, no, it's too late, you've got to go to bed. So I said, don't be so rigid, I need audience. So he came, he sat down, very close, like this young man here, well, he was younger, boy was about 8 or 9. So I said, look, I need a poem, you got any poems? He said, no. I said, come on, make the one. He said, well, can you write it down? I said, yeah, I'll have to talk it. So he sat there, his mother came, I told her to go away with his father, and he dictated the poem to me, and I wrote it down. Here it is, just like this. It's called The Jungle Has Sounds. The lion roars, the monkeys screech, the birds shiver, and at night, all these sounds put together make a chorus. Well, they may not be masterpieces, but they're evidence of a something going on in America that we don't find in the taught in the universities. I have nothing against universities, but I wonder if they teach us that children are natural poets and creative people. And the fact of the fact, most people, unfortunately, spend their lifetime overcoming the brilliance of their youth. Now, there's a struggle going on over the tradition that I'm going to try to develop for you tonight, showing that there are roots for poetry and labor, Indian, folk song, language groups, and so forth. I don't find this being taught in the universities. In the universities, poetry has become a very formalistic study in many of the universities, not all of them, but many of them. And I am struggling, among other things, to rediscover, for all those that will listen to me, a humanist trend in American poetry. Why? Well, sometimes it seems crazy to speak about poetry at a time like this, but sometimes it seems crazy to speak about anything else. Poetry is an exchange of emotion. It is an exchange of energy between the poem and the reader. It does something with language that nothing else does. Just because it uses words does not mean it's a different variety of prose. Poetry takes people out of themselves and gives them a picture of reality they don't get any other way. And it's this picture of reality that's at stake, in my opinion, in this struggle for poetry, because I have my picture of reality, and so does every other poet. And so did Whitman and Fenelon and all the poets of the humanist tradition. But there are other people in this country who also write poems, and very good poems, and they reflect another tradition. Well, I would take as a very shining example of this other tradition a man named Robinson Jeffers. Now, Jeffers is impeccable technically. He has a marvelous technical achievement. And to think that these poets of what I call the inhuman tradition do not have a remarkable command of poetic techniques would be a mistake. They do have. They do have. How then do they reflect what's going on in the lives that we know of, the struggles and so forth? Well, this is my thesis on it. Their perfection of techniques is on a parallel ideologically in the world of poetry with the marvelous technological perfection that we see all around us in the United States, if you have the money to buy it. I mean, there's nobody makes better machines. Our plumbing is fantastically beautiful. Coming across the continent, I don't think I've ever seen the same spigot twice. I mean, we do the most marvelous things with plumbing and fixtures, automobiles, you know. You don't have to do a thing now. You just look at it, and this gear shift. And so we are marvelous mechanics and marvelous machinists. And I think this machine perfection is reflected in the beautiful perfection of form that we find in many of the poets of the school that I am talking about. And an excellent example is Robinson Jeffers. He says very flatly, I do not even pretend to stand with the people. Now he says very simply what many other poets leave unsaid. I, on the other hand, stand for a tradition which makes no bones about standing with the people. So there is a struggle here, because the people who write about Jeffers and who read him will not do anything very much about the poetry that I speak of. There's a struggle for me to get a hearing, just as there's a struggle for Jeffers to get a hearing. You see? Each had a struggle. And I have to go and make my audience among people who are not poetry readers, because the few poetry readers there are in the world today are slowly diminishing, because they simply will not be bothered reading this inhuman tradition, which has become a sort of very recherché industry confined to a few specialists. And the mass of people no longer get whatever sustenance they can get out of the exchange of energy which poetry gives. So I just want to put this before you, that we're not discussing some abstract thesis here tonight. We're discussing a life and death struggle, which is reflected in the field of poetry as it is in music, in art, in the machine shops, and any place else. Bobanowski says that poets are very much like the little birds that miners used to carry in their caps when they went down the mine. This is before the days of the modern lamps. When the air was bad, methane gas and so forth, the birds would faint or die. And he says poets are that way. When the poets begin to suck their lives out and kill themselves or get killed, then there's something rotten in the air. And this is the situation you have in America today, where the poets are being silenced or unread, and very few of us are able to break through. So I had to struggle with my own friends also. My own friends. Not Marital. Marital's an exception. But I don't know whether Marital mentioned, among the places I write for The Nation now, I write for The Worker. I used to be a editor of The Worker. Now I write for The Worker occasionally. Well, I was very pained to see on The Worker the other day that my old friend George Morris, a labor columnist, he wrote a column about May Day quoting the very excellent column that appeared in the IUE News, which is a very conservative labor journal. Now, Reardon, in the IUE News, spoke about the May Day spirit. We should return to the May Day spirit. Says that labor should recapture this holiday, which he says the communists have taken over. We should return to the May Day spirit. Morris commented favorably on this, but he omitted the poetry that Reardon publishes. When I get, now what's the idea? We can't use poetry because we are separate and apart from the people. Here's the IUE News can use poetry. Please send this in a letter to George. I protest. And this poem that Reardon prints is a very beautiful poem. I might move from children's poetry to Solidarity Forever. I suppose you all know the tune for Solidarity Forever. Solidarity Forever. Everybody know the tune? Well, just let me read you some of the verses that Reardon used and which we did not print. They have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn. But without our brains and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong. And he quotes another passage. When the union is inspiration, through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no greater power anywhere beneath the sun. This is a socialist-inspired poem by a man who at that time, John Alshelton, was a socialist, appearing in a conservative journal. I think we could do well to copy more of the poetry and possibly leave out some of our comment on these things. Let these people teach us something. Mr. Reardon, I am for you. More poetry in the IUE News. Well, you go through the labor movement and you find that every passage. Can we work this? Who knows how to work this? Do we have somebody here who knows how to touch the right button? I just want to get...
In the days of 18 and 1, pagan all. In the days of 18 and 1, pagan all. In the days of 18 and 1, pagan shoes was all I done. Hand me down my pegs, my pegs, my pegs, my all. In the days of 18 and 2, pagan all. In the days of 18 and 2, pagan all. In the days of 18 and 2, pagan shoes was all I'd do. Hand me down my pegs, my pegs, my pegs, my all. Yonder in Tennessee, they leased the convicts out. Sent them working in the mine against free labor stout. Free labor rebelled against it. To win it took some time, but when the lease was in effect, it made him rise and shine. But he wants to roll down the line, but he wants to roll down the line. Yonder come my darling, come down the line. But he wants to roll down the line, but he wants to roll down the line. Yonder come my darling, come down the line. Farmer is the man, the farmer is the man, lives on credit till the fall. Then they take him by the hand and they lead him from the land, and the middleman's the one who gets it all.
You can see we're going to have a whole evening and a whole semester. Well, we have to understand that it's precisely the political beliefs that I have that drive me and impel me to find the sources in the people for our inspiration. Because these songs and poems that I'm going to demonstrate to you do not arise out of somebody's head divorced from life. All these songs from the labor movement arise out of actual struggles that people were in. And Pete Seeger, Lee Hayes, Woody Guthrie and so forth. I didn't sing, but we were all together at that time. I helped write some of the songs. And these songs at that time were used all over the country during strikes and so forth. Here's one of them that will recall that period to you.
Travel on down, I am a Union band, for thee to be high. A red-headed woman took me out to dine and says, love me, baby, leave the Union behind.
Get me behind, he said, travel on down the line.
I am a Union man, gonna leave you behind.
Can you stop that?
Let's finish that now.
I was interviewed by the greatest circulation of any college newspaper in the world just before I came here. And the young lady who interviewed me was very interested to learn that Whitman pledged his allegiance to the labor movement. That doesn't mean he was a labor poet. He wasn't. But he determined, what was very different about Whitman and something you do not learn, as far as I can find in any books about Whitman, is the way he based his poetry on working people. Very simple, it's there. And I'd like to quote you one or two words from Whitman to show you that our greatest poet, our national poet, identified himself from beginning to end with the labor movement. Now people say, oh well, workers don't read Whitman. Well, wait. They read him in many other parts of the world, and someday they'll read him in this country. Here's what Whitman said. That he had decided from the beginning of his career, and I quote, without yielding an inch, the working man and working women were to be in my pages from first to last. Here's another indication of his basic integration to working people. He said in one of his poems, he goes through the list of occupations, the mechanics, the carpenters, the masons, the boatmen, the shoemakers, woodcutters, the delicious singing of the mothers, and so forth. All these workers, when he says, I hear America singing, he refers to workers, and he says in the final line, the day belongs to the day, at night the part of young fellows, robust, friendly, singing with open mouths their strong, melodious songs. Working people. So this is a very noble tradition that we are struggling to revive, and it runs through our singer. This is a put to music, however, by a shop worker, Morris Rosenthal, a very great Yiddish labor poet. He says, it's called The Teardrop Millionaire. It's not a tuning fork of gold that sets my throat to sing, nor do my melodies unfold to satisfy a king. The groans of slaves when they are tired awake my bitter song. It's only then I'm inspired to reckon up their wrongs. And this is why I pine away, and half alive I linger. What wages can the workers pay? What pittance to their singer? They pay with tears for every tear. That's all they can afford. I'm a teardrop millionaire and weep upon my horn. The Empire. And Emerson said, it's not meters that make a poem, but a meter making argument. And I think in a meter-making argument, just as you'll hear from Clarence Darrow, he touches the realms of poetry. Now, this was a part of one of his great speeches. I'll only read you a paragraph or two of it. At the time of, I think it was 1905, Bill Hayward was one of the people who was being framed for a murder charge in Idaho. Darrow made an 11-hour appeal to the jury. I just want to read you a few words from the end of it. He says, if at the behest of this mob you should kill Bill Hayward, he is mortal. He will die. But I want to say that a million men will grab up the banner of labor where at the open grave Hayward lays it down. And in spite of prisons, or scaffold, or fire, in spite of prosecution, or jury, or courts, these men of willing hands will carry it to victory in the end. I speak for the poor, for the weak, for the weary, for that long line of men who, in darkness and despair, have borne the labors of the human race. Their eyes upon you, 12 men of Idaho, tonight. If you kill Hayward, your act will be applauded by many. In the railroad offices of our great cities, men will applaud your names. If you decree his death among the spiders of Wall Street, will go up paeans of praise for these 12 good men and true. In every bank in the world where men hate Hayward because he fights for the poor and against the accursed system upon which the favored live and grow rich and fat, from all these you will receive blessings and unstinted praise. But if your verdict should be not guilty in this case, there are still those who will reverently bow their heads and thank these 12 men for their life and reputation you have saved. Out on our broad prairies, where men toil with their hands, out on the broad ocean, where men are tossed and buffeted on the waves, through our mills and factories and deep down under the earth, thousands of men and women and children, men who labor, men who suffer, women and children weary with care and toil, these men and these women will kneel tonight and ask their guide, God, to guide your hearts. Is the culture of the Negro people. You're all familiar with the Negro spirituals. They're part of our musical culture, jazz, the great musical contributions. We're not so familiar, perhaps, with the role that Negro poets play in art poetry. And I would like to give you a sample of what I consider some of the greatest poetry being written today. written by a young Negro poet, about 28 years old, Martin Carter. I'll read you just a few lines from one of his poems. Carter, by the way, is a British, from British Guiana, and was part of the popular government there, which was replaced by the British about 3 or 4 years ago. He wrote these poems during that period. This one is called Ancestor Akabla. When he sent me this poem, this group of poems, I wrote and asked him, who was Ancestor Akabla? So he wrote me back and told me that Akabla was the leader of the first slave revolt against the plantation owners in British Guiana about 150 years ago. And as I read the poem, I wrote him that Akabla was my ancestor too now. I wanted to claim him also. Here a few lines from this poem. Ancestor Akabla. Was ancestor Akabla, was ancestor himself. He stand up like a palm tree, his head touched the sky. Was ancestor Akabla, he said, no more the great chimney, no more, no more the cold wind, no more, no more. He said, when I come back, oh green shelter of long grass, hide me forever and ever. He said, oh woman face of earth, when I come back, let me lie down, kiss me to sleep. But suddenly night fell down from the green roof, and earth rose up like a young woman and took off her clothes to go to sleep, and a copper man. Oh.